All right, everybody, here we are. Oh, we got 1 minute left. Nope, we are right on time. All right, so welcome to the War Room. Our guest tonight is, I don't even know how to say your name.
Mariah.
Mariah. Okay, Mariah Gibbons. And she is here to share the journey that she's been on, and what brought her around to being on our side of the fence, I guess. Myra reached out to me a couple of, I don't know, months ago, and we had a conversation, and then I just had a bunch of War Room speakers, so we had to wait till tonight. All right, welcome. I've heard
Yeah.
such nice things about you. I
Oh,
was
thank you.
in an NCACR meeting, National Coalition Against Conviction Registries meeting earlier this week, and people were like, "Oh, you get to have Mariah on your War Room. How exciting."
Yeah, I might have to change positions really quick because my animals love it when I'm on a video call. They always like to just climb all over me.
Oh, I wish I had animals to climb all over me.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll just get right into it. My presentation isn't super long. I think it's probably going to be about 7 minutes, and then we can like ask questions and stuff like that. But thank you all so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. So yeah, let me just get into
Chuck, do I
this.
have to do something to make it so that she can share?
That's okay. I don't have anything to be sharing on the screen. I'm just going to
Oh,
read.
okay.
Okay, great. So my name is Mariah. I am a microbiologist. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I am the victim of sexual assault. I was raped in the summer of 2024 by a man I was dating. I reported the assault and was then plunged into a whole new world. The failure of the justice system in regards to sexual violence had only ever been on the periphery of my awareness. After my assault, I was experiencing it firsthand. I also had never heard of the sex offender registry before that time. I only started learning about it in the fall of 2025. When I reported my assault to the police, I had a very specific outcome in mind that I wanted. I did not want the person who harmed me to go to prison. I did not think that that was appropriate for the context of his crime. I would describe to the police, the prosecutor, and lawyers what I was looking for, and for the most part, they all seemed to think that what I was asking for was not available as an option in our current justice system. The criminal court could give the person who harmed me a conviction and a prison sentence. The civil court could give me a money judgment against him, but I wanted neither. I did not give up. I knew that there must be other victims who also wanted what I wanted and were likewise not being served by our justice system. So I set out to change the justice system so that it would function as I envisioned for myself and other victims like me. I was not introduced to the term restorative justice until the summer of 2025, a whole year after my assault. It was a civil attorney who said, "I think what you're looking for is called restorative justice." I then dove into researching restorative justice and discovered that yes, indeed, this was exactly what I had been looking for. I just hadn't had a word for it until then. I was ecstatic to discover that what the type of justice I wanted did in fact exist. It just wasn't a part of the justice system yet for sex crimes. This was the point at which I began to do research into how the justice system functioned, and through this effort, I discovered diversion. I had never heard of diversion before. I really was naive about the entire justice system. I started this journey knowing practically nothing about it. Once I read about the concept of diversion, I knew it was exactly what I needed to create, a diversion program for sexual assault. I will explain diversion in case anyone listening is not already familiar with the term. In diversion, a case is diverted, as the name implies, away from the traditional justice system. A diversion program often includes things like therapy, restorative justice, community service, or writing apology letters. Diversion is a form of accountability that focuses on rehabilitation rather than punishment. When someone completes a diversion program, either their case is never charged or their charge and conviction are expunged. The focus of diversion is getting the person who caused harm back on their feet and headed in the direction of a crime-free life. I will also define restorative justice for anyone who is unfamiliar with that term. Restorative justice asks who is harmed and what do they need to have that harm repaired. Unlike the traditional justice system, which is adversarial and often called re-traumatizing by victims, restorative justice is victim-centered. Restorative justice usually takes place in a conference setting, which often looks like the victim, the person who caused harm, and community members such as friends or family of the two parties meeting face to face and sitting in a circle together. This conference is facilitated by a trained restorative justice facilitator. The person who caused harm takes full accountability for the harm that he caused. Those in attendance have the opportunity to discuss how the crime affected them and ask questions. At the end of the conference, the person who caused harm enters into a voluntary agreement of specific actions he will take to repair the harm he caused. A case could conclude after one restorative justice conference or many. It simply depends on the needs of the parties in each case. The objective of restorative justice is repairing harm, not punishment. I grew up Mormon, attended the Mormon University BYU in Utah, and even served a Mormon mission. I left that religion because I realized it did not measure up to my values. But in my heart, I am still a missionary. I no longer preach the gospel of an organized religion, but I will always consider it my duty to serve others and to be actively engaged in making the world a better place. Restorative justice aligns perfectly with my personal values. I believe crime is most often the result of factors such as generational trauma, mental illness, poverty, stress, and poor behavior modeling. I conceptualize crime as a cry for help, and I believe the justice system's role should be focused less on punishment and more on healing, education, and treatment. I discovered the registry as I was formulating plans for my diversion program for sexual assault. I wanted diversion to come after a guilty plea. It would go like this. The defendant pleads guilty, completes the diversion program, which would consist of sex offender treatment and restorative justice, and then once the program is completed, the defendant's charge and conviction would be expunged. Putting diversion at that point in the justice system did the best job, in my opinion, of pairing accountability with forgiveness. However, this is the point at which I discovered the registry, and I realized that this version of my diversion program could not function with the registry in place, because once someone has a sex crime conviction, even if it were to be expunged, they would still be required to register in other states. So this discovery made me realize that I would need to change the registry laws on a national level before I would be able to implement a post-plea diversion program for sexual assault. I have now pivoted to first creating a pre-charge diversion program. Long-term, however, I still have my sights on post-plea diversion. Currently, I'm creating a pre-charge diversion program for sexual assault in Ramsey County here in Minnesota. The district attorney has been very supportive of both justice for sexual assault cases and using diversion programs in general. When I pitched the idea of using diversion for sexual assault to him, he was very receptive and loved the idea immediately. He asked if it had ever been done before, and I said yes. Mary Koss, a researcher at the University of Arizona, did a diversion program for sexual assault in Pima, Arizona in the early 2010s. It was a fantastic success. She published a research paper about it, and the only reason it did not continue is because she ran out of funding. The county attorney then asked me if there was a coalition of survivors who supported this, and I answered yes. I am a part of a worldwide coalition called Survivors for Justice Reform. It was founded by a Canadian survivor named Marley Liss, who took her rape case away from the court process and ended it with the person who harmed her going to treatment and restorative justice. Survivors for Justice Reform is 800 members strong across the world, and there are 7 members in Minnesota at the moment. I am the head of the Minnesota chapter. I believe this diversion program will be beneficial to many groups of people, beneficial to victims, beneficial to those who have caused harm, and beneficial to the community at large. Diversion allows the person who caused harm to hold himself accountable without the overly harsh punishments of a conviction and prison sentence. It gives the victim the option of a different pathway to justice, which centers the victim's needs. And because diversion is centered in rehabilitation, education, and healing, those who complete diversion, I believe, will be a benefit to the whole community. Although my efforts currently are focused on creating diversion programs, I do want to work on reform of the registry as well. I do not see the registry as being helpful. If anything, I believe it causes more harm than good. It exacerbates the exact factors that are associated with criminal behavior: isolation, social outcasting, employment instability, housing instability, depression, and mental illness. And it affects not just those who are on the registry, but their loved ones as well. It is used over broadly for many crimes that simply have no business requiring a registry. The administration costs of the registry are enormous, and it brings out the worst in our society. It gives society a group to ostracize, outcast, and generally treat with hatred and fear that is undeserved and poisonous to our culture. And further, the registry harms victims because it perpetuates the monster offender stereotype. This leads to juries acquitting when they don't see the defendant as matching the stereotype of a sex offender that they imagine. We as a society must come to the realization that those who commit sex offenses are everyday people. They are our brothers, sons, friends, coworkers, family members, and loved ones. They are people we love and people who are deserving of our love. We must create a justice system that is built on compassion and healing rather than retribution and scorn. That is my story. That is how I found myself an advocate and an activist, working to create a more compassionate and effective justice system for all those affected by sexual violence, both those who have been harmed and those who have caused harm. We can create a solution that is healing for all.
Wow, I love it. I wish everybody who had ever had anything happen to them could think like you think. So you're working within your county to make some changes. I can't imagine that you got this change to happen for your case. You're working for the future, right? Whoops, hang on. It's saying you're muted again. I don't know how that happened.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay.
So for my case, it is currently I'm kind of trying to do that with my case, but like through a civil lawsuit instead of the criminal justice system. But I mean, yeah.
So what happened with your case? It's still pending?
So with the criminal justice system, the prosecutors declined to charge for my
Okay.
case.
Okay.
So if I were ever, I still kind of have a little bit of hope that I might be able to go this route in the future because Minnesota doesn't have a statute of limitations for criminal sex crimes or
Okay.
in the criminal court. So there is a possibility that maybe sometime in the future, after I've created diversion, I could possibly get this case diverted. But honestly, really, I'm just doing this for everyone else. Like I'm just,
Future. Yeah.
yeah, for everyone who comes
Doing it
after.
for the people in the future.
Yeah.
And were you able to have any meaningful interactions with the person who caused you harm?
So my interaction with him that came closely after the assault was I talked to him about it in a conversation in person, and he like apologized to me for it, but I think he didn't in the conversation, he didn't quite comprehend or understand that it was sexual assault because he had also injured me in the case of it, and like I was bleeding and stuff. So like he knew that he had caused harm. And so when he apologized to me, I think he was apologizing that he injured me, but like not conceptualizing or understanding that it was in fact also an assault, like it was also a crime. So
And then the fact that that the DA failed to prosecute probably just made him think, oh, see,
exactly. And that's the
it's not
problem with
what
the
you were
current
looking
criminal
for.
justice system is that when prosecutors are declining cases or when juries are acquitting, they are reinforcing in people's minds that this person didn't actually commit an offense. And then that's just perpetuating this myth that like women often lie about being raped, right? So that's a part of the reason why it was so important to me to push for this reform is because like I'm seeing this cycle that's happening and I'm like, we have to break this cycle. And that's really what I see diversion as, is it's an opportunity to break that cycle.
Yeah. Wow. How did you find your way to this group? You said there's 800 women across the world. What was the name of that people like you in different places who want to, can you tell me the name of that again?
It's called Survivors for Justice Reform. And I can put it in the chat. And let's see here, Survivors for Justice
Could
Reform.
also keep talking and I could go find it and put it in the chat.
Yeah, and then if you like look that up, or if you just type in survivorsforjusticereform.com, then you'll be able to find it. It will come up.
All right, I'm going to work on that while you answer either Francine with her hand up or looks like Anne has a question in the chat.
Okay, so I see a question here that says, how many individuals do you think might be eligible or benefit from the diversion program? How many cases would you estimate are actually in the diversion program? So right now, the diversion program hasn't been created yet. It is being created in Ramsey County here in Minnesota. But there was a diversion program in the past in Pima, Arizona that was led by Mary Koss. And I can't really speculate about exactly which cases would be eligible for diversion, but in my opinion, I would really like to see a lot of them, like just like most cases, I would like to see going through diversion. And I think the big reason why I see that is being the case that that should be available is because I have spoken with the director of a sex offender treatment program here in St. Paul in Minnesota. And it was her opinion too. She's the director of a sex offender treatment clinic. And it was her opinion that this, like 90% of cases currently that aren't even being charged, that we could be putting those through diversion. And it would just be a huge benefit, I think, to our communities.
Yeah. Okay. And then Francine has her hand up. Let me unmute Francine. All right. Go, Francine.
Oh, I think she's still muted.
Oh, maybe she
Oh,
unmuted herself.
hey
I thought it was
there.
that.
Hey there. I'm in Florida. My son had consensual sex and was put on the registry. He signed his plea deal at the age of 19. People like that would be excellent. Like, in, if we could figure, because I'm trying to change a law too, if we could try to figure out something like that and then get like your professional person that you said that a sex offender treatment said, hey, that would be a great idea. Like, I think if we got a bunch of these people and physicians, maybe ex-probation officers, things like that, and put it together, I really think it would be a really great idea because, as you say, they're targeting people, and there was a very hideous, heinous crime that just happened to a young man here in Florida, and who had just, it was a teenage indiscretion, just like my son was. So I think that would be real important if we could get something, if not for all cases, at least things like that, things that really shouldn't be publicly targeted and hunted. Do you know what I'm saying? So I do want to respond to that in that so you mentioned that your son had consensual sex. I do not envision this diversion program as like catching things that aren't crimes. And obviously like we don't want innocent people having to go through the justice system at all. But I did want to make it clear that I'm not creating it just so that I mean I guess it would be like
It was a crime that her son did get a, I mean, it was a crime because he was over 18 and they were under 18.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay. Yeah.
So he did get charged, you know,
Okay. Yeah.
he's on the
Yeah.
registry.
Yeah.
He's
I,
facing all the same bad problems.
yeah. I see what you're saying now. I don't, I think that there are a lot of things like that that you just described that are not deserving of like the harsh punishments that the justice system gives right now. Like the, even having the conviction on someone's register or on someone's record, I think is an overly harsh punishment for something like that. Like that can exclude you from a lot of jobs, from professions. It really can ruin a person's life, and I don't think that that's necessary. And so yeah, for something like that, I think that diversion would be very, very beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. John has his hand up. Do I? Yes, you're unmuted, John.
Good evening, and many, many thanks for your comments. A couple of things. The most important thing is I've worked with a group here in Arkansas, Victims' Rights Arkansas, and I've talked to them. They know full well what happened to me, my background. So that was a good opening right there. In talking with them, this one particular group has determined that if someone has been falsely accused, wrongly convicted of a crime, including a sexual abuse allegation, anything like that, that they should be viewed, they should be treated, they should be considered the same as a crime victim. What is your take on this view, and how do you see this being applied to, say, restorative justice practice?
So someone who has been falsely accused, is that that's what you're asking?
That's
Is
the first part. That's the first part.
that they should be viewed as a crime victim?
They've been found, well, like in me, found guilty and put on the registry. But when proof has arisen that the person was falsely accused, this particular victims' rights group has determined that people who have been falsely accused should be treated as if they were themselves a victim of a crime. So your take on that, that's the first thing.
So I don't know a lot about that. I would say, like people who have been exonerated after a conviction definitely have the right to, and many of them do, sue the government, for their false conviction. And I think that that should be a path that is available to anyone. In the sense of like the diversion program, with like the diversion program, for instance, for people who are falsely accused, I guess I'm not really even thinking about the diversion program as being for them because I don't think that they should be in the justice system at all. Like, I think if someone is falsely accused, then their case shouldn't be charged and that it shouldn't go through diversion or anything like that. So I guess I'm not sure if I answer that very well. I'm sorry.
Well, if I may, in my particular case, I was frankly pressured into making a plea bargain. And even though there have been some pretty good indications that the people who accused me admitted that they had made it up, it still has not been in any way, shape, or form of any help to me. And I'm still on my state's register. But in talking about that with this victims' rights group, they believe that someone who has been in that particular set of circumstances, that particular set of conditions, should be considered as if I was a crime victim, that I myself was a crime victim. And I wanted to get your take on what this particular victims' rights group has been saying. That was the first thing. And the second, for people who have been wrongly convicted, falsely accused, and in my case, on the registry for quite a number of years, how can that figure into restorative justice?
Those are really interesting. I really have not thought about that much at all. Those are very interesting points that you brought up. I think I agree with the crime victims group's assessment that you mentioned. John, can we not do this? It's too much noise. I think that yes, as you mentioned, that would I mean you it would be like you are a victim because you are a victim of the criminal justice system, right? Or you could say that you're a victim of a false accusation. And also, as far as restorative justice goes, I mean, you can still participate in restorative justice, certainly. There are restorative justice circles where you can have community members come, or you can have surrogate victims or surrogate people who have caused harm. They have restorative justice circles like that. So you can definitely still participate in a restorative justice circle and it can still be very healing. If you wanted to participate, if you were saying something like you wanted to participate in a restorative justice circle with the people who accused you, that might be a little bit more difficult because restorative justice is voluntary. It's by necessity voluntary. And so they would have to be willing and want to participate in that. And I'm not saying that it can't be done. It certainly can, but that would have to be something that they would want to participate in.
Right now, that's kind of doubtful. And in addition, one of the two who accused me was kicked out of the country a long, long time ago. Quick diversion. I see you have a cat too.
What was the name of the woman? I think it was in Arizona, that place that had a diversion program and it got stopped. I want to put that in the check. Someone missed the
Yeah, so that was
okay.
Mary Koss.
Koss.
Yeah, sorry, I will put it in the chat so you have the spelling. Her name was
Okay.
Mary, and that's Dr. Mary Koss. She's a PhD. Yeah, and that was in Pima, Arizona,
Okay. And how do you spell the Arizona?
at
Pima?
the University of, there we go. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. This is someone who got here late. Okay, Amber has her hand up. Sorry. There's two. All right, Amber, you were unmuted.
Hi, Mariah. It's nice to see you. This is Amber from Restorative Action Alliance.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your amazing work and developing this program. I wanted to ask you, as you're in conversations with the district attorney's office, have there been any discussions on, as you know, because restorative justice and restorative practices are voluntary, this idea of a diversion program, which has been applied for violent crimes and other sorts of crimes in the past, sometimes runs into sort of bumping up against the system having pressure points. So, this idea that, well, you can plead guilty and you'll have access to this diversion program. So, there are pressing points, if you will, or influence points that are like, do this, or your alternative is something else. So, has there been any discussion about what that looks like within the system in terms of what is actually voluntary?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a really great point to bring up. So currently, diversion is being used for a lot of other crimes, but just not very violent crimes. So, right. So it's oftentimes used for drug offenses, for like shoplifting, for like DUIs, things like that. And it is true that the way that the system is set up right now is that it does like highly incentivize a person to do diversion, especially if we're talking about like they're at the plea bargain state. Well, really any stage, right? Because it's like even if it's pre-charge, if the prosecutor is approaching someone and saying, "We're ready to charge this case, but if you don't want it to be charged, you could go through diversion." That's still like very highly incentivizing diversion as opposed to having your case charged and then moving towards trial. So there definitely is an ethical conversation about this that is happening, just like on a national level, where prosecutors are discussing like the ethics of even having plea deals, because it's something like 90 to 99% of all cases in the criminal justice system that are resolved through plea deals instead of going to trial. And they do that in large part simply because of capacity, because they just like even at that percentage, our courts are still overbooked. And there are many cases that are scheduled years and years out just because of it being overbooked. And so they do that to cut down on the number of cases going to trial, so they highly incentivize these plea deals. And I think that there is this component that is definitely a very good argument to be made about how this is kind of maybe not entirely voluntary because these people are being pressured into taking plea deals. And so that definitely is an ethical concern. I think I still consider diversion to be voluntary because I s consider it to be that people still do have the option to go to trial if they want to.
So if I might, I think that, it's a spectrum, right? And so what we see with diversion programs of all kinds is that when done well and fully staffed and fully funded, that these can be very beneficial to individuals to keep them out of the system. So that's sort of the consideration to be thinking about as it's being developed, because even if somebody is incentivized and willing, that is a part of, voluntary participation. And then if they are paired with skilled facilitators and trained individuals who can work with them to get them to a place of a restorative conference or restorative practice, then that will be beneficial to everyone. Some of the challenges in other programs, particularly like some of the ones that we've seen in New York, is not being fully funded, not being fully staffed, corners being cut, and in restorative practices, when corners are cut and people aren't ready, to be frank, sometimes bringing people together can be harmful.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So that's like important consideration. I'm so excited about what you're doing, and thank you. And I don't want to take up any more time.
Yeah, no problem. Great comments and great question. Thank you, Amber.
All right, Kathy, you are unmuted.
Mariah, thank you so much for being here and for your work in doing this. I'm in Michigan, and I belong to a group called Friends of Restorative Justice. We're trying to get the criminal justice system to use restorative justice in more cases. They're pretty far away from sexual harm cases, but I would love to see that. I just wanted to let you and Amber and other people who are interested in restorative justice know that there is another group. It's called Restorative Justice and Sexual Harm Working Group, and it's a national group of people, a lot of survivors, but also people who do restorative justice that want to do it in sexual harm cases. And we meet every other month on Zoom. And it was formed 2 years ago. Every other year, there's a conference called the National Alliance of Community and Restorative Justice, NACRJ. And it's going to be July in New Orleans. But people that were there that want to do restorative justice and sexual harm have been meeting for the past 2 years, trying to figure out how to help each other to do it. And I can put my, I can't
can
just,
put,
they don't have a website or anything.
Okay.
Somebody has to come in like recommended by me or something, but I'll put my email in the chat along with the name of this group. Okay.
Perfect. All right, John, you're up.
So, excuse me. Hello again. I've been following for quite some time now practices, not just regarding, if you will, crime and punishment, but for rehabilitation programs that are taking place in a lot of countries in Europe. And I'd like to ask you your take, your opinion on what you have seen, what you understand, what's going on in these various areas where incarceration is a last resort, not a first resort, unlike here. And are there, as you see it, are there practices in these other countries that you think, that you believe have got to be prioritized, that have got to be introduced in this country, in the state, for things to really turn around, for things to really start improving?
Personally, I think the problem in the United States is that we're not looking for improvement. We're not trying for improvement. We're trying to just keep that prison industrial complex going. We're making a lot of money on this whole process. Oh, okay. Hang on. Sorry. It says ask to unmute. I don't know why.
Okay. Yeah. For some reason, it
there
makes me ask to unmute every time.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. I actually... Okay, so have you ever heard of the Little Scandinavia Project? So the Scandinavian countries have a prison system where, first of all, they have way fewer incarcerated people than in the United States. And their prisons are like small villages. Like people are in basically kind of like really nice apartments there instead of like in jail cells. And they have like people go to work. They have like professions there. They'll like go into the mechanic shop or and then they have like stores. So they like earn money and then they go spend their money in the stores to buy their food. And then they have access to a kitchen and they can make their own meals instead of like being served meals. And so they did this experiment in the United States in, it was Pennsylvania. And they called it Little Scandinavia, where they took a section of the prison and they converted it into something that was similar to one of these Scandinavian prisons. And that started back in 2019. And as far as I understand, it is still going. They're still doing it there, but it's just in this one prison in Pennsylvania. And they've had really good results. Like what they have seen is that inmates have much better mental health. They're much more positive. They become a lot better and more ready to reintegrate into society once they're released from prison. It's just overall, they've had really, really good results from this, basically just from treating people better. And really they talk about it. They made a documentary about it. It was a really fascinating documentary. And they talked about how in these Scandinavian countries, like the way they view it is that just being in prison itself, like being separated from your friends and family, is like the kind of punishment aspect of it. And there shouldn't be any punishment on top of that. So the people who are in prison are treated with respect by the guards, and they're given all of these allowances, you know, of like things they can do. And anyways,
they eat together. Yes, I watched a little thing about that. Like the guards and the prisoners sit at the table together and they're just nice to each other. It's a whole different thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I loved it. If you can go watch the documentary, it's a little bit hard to find because I actually had to I had to get a VPN so I could watch it on like an Australian channel or something. It's like not easily accessible to watch this documentary. It's weird, but yeah, it's called like Little Scandinavia or like Little Scandinavia Project, and I highly recommend it. It was so good, and I think that we need to have more of those types of like prisons here in America. And I agree with you that prison should be a last resort, not a first resort, and that we should have many more rehabilitation programs available before anyone ends up in prison.
I would love, I mean, maybe that's a thing I do on this call sometime. Maybe I go find the movie and we play it here and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Would people be up for that? That sound like something that would be,
I think that'd be cool.
I watched just a little bit of one of those things about the Scandinavian Project and thought, this is a whole different ballgame. So much better. All right, I'll put that on my list of things to do. And then the alternative, the opposite of the Prison Project, I just watched. Has anyone seen the movie The Alabama Solution? That was terrible. Whoops. Why does it keep doing that?
Sorry. that was really bad. I mean, watching that just broke my heart. It really did.
Yeah, the Alabama Solution is sort of the opposite. That's like, how could we do this the worst possible way? That's the way Alabama is doing it.
Yep.
Okay, someone just said, I'd be very surprised if they allowed sex crimes in the program. Yeah, well, that's probably true. That the United States is not the place where we're like, oh, how can we make things easier for people with sex? Yes, very on brand. Okay, have I missed any questions in the chat? Megan, you're talking about escaping to Europe. I have a couple of audio files from war rooms about life in other countries. I can send you those. Someone, Megan, found the a link about the Pima, Arizona, Mary Koss. That link takes you to a thing where you could learn all about that.
Oh, did you need that link?
Need what link?
To Mary Koss's research.
I mean, someone found it.
Someone found it.
Put it in the chat. Yeah, so it'll be available for everyone when they save this chat. And then there's yours. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the harm done to people by the criminal justice system is like an accident. I think it's just baked into the pie at this point. I think this is the way we've been doing it for enough years. And, you know, I love seeing more and more people recognizing that, you know, putting a prison in every rural town, everywhere, all over the place, and then having, you know, tons and tons of people working at those prisons and just treating people that way. Like, it's not good for any of us. It's not good for the people who are serving time. It's not good for the people who are the guards in those prisons. This isn't a healthy way to treat other human beings. It's not good for the families of the people in the prisons. It's just bad all around. And you know, if you've ever looked, Prison Policy Initiative. Has anybody ever been on the Prison Policy Initiative site? The United States, if we were to sort the United States states by how many people we incarcerate, you know, from the least incarcerated state to the highest incarcerated state, if you treated every single state as a country, you have to go like way down to like Louisiana before you have any other countries who even come close. It's 10 times less. And even if you go down to the 10 times less part, the countries that incarcerate 10 times fewer people than us, or 1/10 of the people that we incarcerate, those are not like, it's not Denmark and Sweden and France. It's like, you know, Ecuador and, you know, Rwanda. It's not places that we're trying to be like. So in the United States, we've just gotten so used to it because it's been going like this for, since the 90s. We've had this tough on crime, double,
Yeah.
the penalties. And you do that for, what is that now? 90s is, it's like 35 years away. Well, people don't even remember what it was like when we didn't incarcerate 10 times more people than any other country. We don't remember what that's like. We think this is normal because this is the way, most people aren't that much older than that.
Yeah.
It is the legacy of slavery, 100%.
It is, yeah.
All right, all you people who are putting these nice comments in the chat, you feel free to raise your hands and talk to us out loud. Prisons are not designed for incarceration. That's right. All right, raise your hands, people. You got more questions? You got comments? Don't make me squint and read your comments out of the comments. The carceral system in the United States is an enormous money making. Yeah, I have 100%.
Yeah, I think that's terrible. I think we need to make it so that they can't make money off of prisoners.
Well, but at this point, they've been making money off of prisoners for so long that, all the systems are just entrenched. So many states have signed, they've got for-profit prisons in their facilities. They've signed contracts with those for-profit prisons saying, we promise we're going to keep your beds 80% full or 90% full. In the 1990s, crime rates were kind of higher, and so maybe it seemed sensible then, but violent crime has dropped dramatically. I read the other day that violent crime is lower than it's been since the 1900s. And yet we're still filling these prison beds. And, so many people are getting rich off of it that I don't know how to go back from that. I don't know how to convince people that we're doing it wrong. And even if we could, at the point where they're so well entrenched, and I mean, maybe we should also watch that Alabama solution. That was,
Yeah.
ugh. All right, John.
Well, I could bring up quite a few things. I was taking a look at Gail E's most recent submission about, so sounds like they probably do have some sex offenders, as she puts in there. Well, please do keep in mind that other countries, notably those in Europe, have a far more open, and I mean to research and to non-punitive actions when it comes to sexual offenses, sexual misconduct, in that Holland, the Scandinavian countries are standout examples of mandatory sex and relationship education, which cuts way down on the number of sexual assaults, sex crimes, and so on. Here, this country, it's been part and parcel of our history from the get-go is that we have this incredibly bizarre love-hate relationship with sex and sexuality. And so you've got that going on. A couple of other comments I could throw at you. One, excuse me, is that until it happens to you, technically to you, there are some, like what happened with me. I was going through life very, very blasé. Oh, I'm ne nothing ever is going to happen to me. Nothing is ever, ever going to go wrong. I'm never going to wind up in trouble with the law until I get a very fateful knock one December afternoon on my front door and my life is turned upside down. So you've got these beliefs that, again, until unless it happens to you, to them, I'm immune. Nothing. So why should I worry about it? So that's one thing. Another is that, and I've brought this up on some of these talks before, but I think it's something to bring up again. There have been these exercises that have taken place from time to time to get people, excuse me, to experience what it's like for a person who's been incarcerated, the hurdles, the obstacles, the hoops they have to jump through when they get back into the community. And so many people are completely unaware. They draw a complete blank about that. So perhaps a tool to have is one of these simulation exercises, and to use whether it's going to be a shaming or challenge, maybe even a monetary reward or something like that, to get more people to, in a way, experience what it's like to go through these hurdles to see what it's like to get back into the community. I've seen some very good PSAs, if you will. There was one that another registrant put out. I think it was out in California, and it was animation, if you will, but very, very effective, of a young man who made the mistake of clicking on a website that took him to child porn, and his life was completely, totally, permanently destroyed by that experience. And one of the things that was brought up is how easy it is for something like that to happen, how easy it is for that life to be, if you will, destroyed. So, and I put in a little comment earlier, and frankly, I copied this from the Florida Action Committee. I put it in the chat a while ago, and it echoes not only what you've been talking about this evening, but it echoes this view that unless or until something happens, why should I worry? Why should I get involved? Why should it matter to me? So those are a few comments. I'm sorry if it sounds a little disjointed, but there's been a lot of work, groups such as WAR, bringing attention to this, bringing attention to it. And there's this incredible amount, not only of, say, oh, I'm immune, if you will, but there is this incredible amount of ignorance. And I plead guilty to that, being very ignorant to what happened. You know, I'm a walking example. I go around to anyone who's willing to listen to start out by saying, if I knew then what I know now.
Ain't that the truth?
But the anything that could be done, and sorry about preaching, if you will, but anything that could be done, not only for education, but to get people to more fully understand the implications, the consequences, if you will. Before she died, I was working with the family member of another registrant here about coming up with a PSA, a sort of a television commercial that would challenge everyday assumptions about persons on the register. And it was a way of doing it in such a way that, you mean it's not the dirty old man? And it's designed to get people to think. But again, any and all of these efforts that are being done, they need to be done. Conventional wisdom needs to be challenged.
Yeah. So Megan or Mariah, if you, I assume that as you're developing this program in Minnesota, are you working with people from other states as well? Are there other people from other states who are helping with that project or wanting to copy it for their states?
Yes, in fact. Like I said, I mentioned the Survivors for Justice Reform Coalition. And so there are all these survivors at different points in the process. And some of them are working on getting legislation passed that gives restorative justice conferences confidentiality, which is a necessary piece to that. People who have caused harm have to be able to admit to things within the restorative justice conference that will then not be able to be used against them in court, either in civil or in criminal court. And so that legislation has to be in place first. I've also been in contact with some people in Colorado who are not part of the coalition, but they're actually part of a different coalition in Colorado who is promoting using restorative justice for gender-based violence. And they recently had, I think she said that they had the first case where they had a prosecutor who didn't think that they could charge the case, but offered the defendant diversion. Or not, sorry, it wasn't diversion. Well, it was some form of diversion because I don't think they have an official diversion program yet, but it was that he was going to go to restorative justice instead of having the case charged. So that's something that they're kind of working on over there in Colorado. But yeah.
Do you know Dr. Jean Ira Katz? He's
No.
anti-registry and he's a therapist in Colorado who's done some awesome work. We'll find he's in the chat.
In Colorado. Okay. Yeah, Colorado, it does seem like, is doing some stuff with restorative justice and gender-based violence.
Yeah. All right. I gotta go. All right, we got another hand up. Jim, you're unmuted. I think you're unmuted. No.
Well,
Now you're
okay,
unmuted.
now
There we go.
I was tapping it and it wasn't unmuting there.
We might have
So,
both been.
one thing, how long do you think the perpetrator or those who cause harm should be in a diversion program. I'm thinking a lot of them would love to be in a diversion program just to get out of prison. So you're not really sure how well they really mean it, or that you truly really want to be free, was one of my questions there. You're not really positive. And I think there should be faith-based programs, because I believe only God could change their heart. So I don't know how sure you would are that these programs would work if they, you know, you don't know how, what, if they really mean to be free from this stuff, and how long they would be in, for one thing. So that's it.
So to answer your question, restorative justice is available at any point in the justice process. So even after someone has been convicted, even after they've served their sentence, even after they've been released from prison and they go back to the community, restorative justice can happen at any time. Like I said, it's voluntary, and it just is dependent on the parties who want to come together and to be in that conference. But as far as the diversion program goes, the diversion program would only be available at certain points in the justice process. And so that would not be available to people who are already incarcerated or have already served their sentence. It would only be available for future cases. So future cases coming into the criminal justice system would have the diversion program available either before charge, before the case is charged, or during the plea bargain stage. And then they would have the opportunity to complete a diversion program. But
well,
unfortunately,
I'm saying either one, how long do you feel they should be in it or can be in it?
So the diversion program, a lot of diversion programs last for about a year, but it really depends a lot on the sex offender treatment program. And so part of what treatment is for is helping the person be able to take accountability for the harm that they caused. And that can sometimes take years. And so I think that the usual program length for that is about 2.5 years. And it really just depends on the individual and on the case. And so like my diversion program, I'm really envisioning as being very flexible and as being able to accommodate a variety of cases. Some that maybe they only need to participate in a restorative justice conference, and maybe they're through with the program in a few weeks or a few short months, or others that might last for a year or maybe even 2 years. So I think it really would just depend on the case, and I would want it to not be a one-size-fits-all approach.
Yeah. Okay, somebody just put in a message about, sorry, I'm old and my eyeballs don't work as they used to. So this is an example of one of the books written by this person, Lisa Ann Zilney. You want to raise your hand and talk for a minute and tell us all about her, Megan?
I knew you were going to do that to me, Anne. I love the chat so much better. But when I just want to qualify myself, my partner was arrested in September, about 7 months ago, and I have two kiddos. So I leapt into action because I am Mama Bear, and I felt like they were innocent victims in this entire process. So Lisa works at another university and does research on this, has written 4 or 5 books on the laws and how they don't work. And what caught my attention was the work she has done on the collateral damage of these laws and the way that they're carried out. So I just wanted to share that, and I wanted to make sure that you knew of her. Because anytime these people can come together, I feel like that's when we really make something happen, because there's so many of us out there, but we're so siloed, and we make the most noise when we come together and kind of collaborate. So if you hadn't heard of her, I just wanted to make sure that she was in the chat for you to look at.
Thank you so much. I will look into that.
Thanks, Anne.
You're welcome. Sorry for making you talk out instead of chat. Because otherwise, how are my old lady eyes going to read these tiny words? So John, you've got Families Against Mandatory Minimum coming on your show next week. I don't know a whole lot about Families Against Mandatory Minimum, because I've always, and maybe I'm wrong, but I've always been told that FAM doesn't really want to work with people on the registry, that they have not been especially open to our side of the that they tend to be the, you know, exclusion, they exclude us from whatever they figure out. Is that not true anymore?
That's one thing
Coming
I'm going
home.
to find out because I've got a question that over the years I've been asking a lot of criminal justice reform groups that are on the program. And the question that I ask is that for criminal justice reform to really work, should it be applied without exceptions or exclusion? I've learned that if I go around the say talking specifically about registrants. Okay, some people are just gonna and or they're gonna go la la la, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things I've learned is to really drive home that fact is to open up the question, or if you prefer, conceal or what is it? Ulterior motives, hide the ulterior motives, and to have them go on the record and talk about exclusions, exceptions. See, I learned this in bringing this up and frankly embarrassing one of our state senators some years ago. I asked him that question and he hemmed and hawed around was saying, well, there's crimes and then there's crimes. So he was not committing himself to it. And what's interesting and a little bit ironic is that about a year or so later, that same state senator was himself arrested and convicted of felony charges. And for a time, it looked like there was going to be like a sexual assault
Was
charge
the
added to it.
and
His
this is another one.
mistress had pictures of him dressed up as a Mucha Lucha character
Word.
when they were together. And of course, the press, at least momentarily here, had a field day with that. But I learned that in some instances, it is necessary to carefully frame the question. And the one has been, do you believe that criminal justice reform must be applied without exceptions, without exclusions of any kind? Now, right now, that's the question that I'm going to be
That you're going to ask them
posing.
tomorrow, or
That I'm, it's not tomorrow, but next week.
all right. Anne has some knowledge about families against mandatory minimums, and hopefully she's going to tell me I'm wrong about that. You're unmuted, Anne, I think. No, you're not unmuted. Now you're unmuted.
UV4 and several of us confronted FAM about that well over a year ago. And they were very receptive. We had a whole meeting about it.
Really?
They certainly do represent all of us. So,
Wow. Well, thank you.
and they're an excellent resource, very professional. They have, and their employees are almost all formerly incarcerated. So,
Wow.
so don't hesitate to.
Maybe I should have them on, and because I've been doing this work for about 3 years, and I missed that little detail that someone had reached out to them and got, you know,
Yeah, it
somebody
wasn't
years ago told me,
before.
oh, fam, don't talk to fam. They won't
Yeah.
communicate with us. But
Yeah.
you've changed that.
No longer true. Yeah.
Hot damn.
Good.
Good job. All right, Amber.
And I remember that meeting. I was with some members of the of United Voices for Sex Offense Reform on that meeting. And one of the things was they were to
Wait, what happened?
learn like what are the barriers that people are facing to belonging in criminal legal reform spaces. And so their official position has never been that they exclude people with sexual offenses. What happened was people with sexual offenses would go into their spaces and people would be, you know, other advocates would be saying things like, oh, those people with sexual offenses, this and that, and they would feel like they didn't belong. And then there were some legislative pushes where carve-outs were part of the process. And so it's not to say that FAM doesn't have a little bit more to learn. But it's important for people like Anne and all the other folks that participate in those groups, to show up in those spaces, just like other, you know, marginalized groups continue to show up in spaces to say, I'm here and this is what matters to this group. So it's just
important. You're absolutely right.
Even if you're told, oh, well, these people don't accept us or that group doesn't accept us, like, to continue to show up, because that's what changes it. That's what humanizes it. And it's hard and it's grinding, but that's those are the facts.
Well, I mean, and this is a perfect example of if people from UV4SOR hadn't shown up for those meetings with FAM, maybe they would still have this reputation and they would still be. But if someone calls them out on it and says, like, hey, when you make these kind of comments when we are in this space, that is making some of us not want to show up, and them having to stop and think about their behavior and have internal conversations about, oh, yeah, good point. And, you know, and it's just the kind of it's like the way, you know, on a offender's wife community on Facebook, for example, sometimes people in their chats, just, you know, random individual people will say something that's kind of like, ah, that's an ouch. And I love it that part of what the admins on that group do is sometimes say, eh, yeah, we try to avoid this particular comment or this kind of line of thinking because it's excluding people and it's making people not feel safe in this group. And yeah, that's fantastic. Maybe I'll read. And do you know anybody from FAM who might answer a call if I asked them to come on here and talk about anything? Oops, hang on.
The director, Dr. Shaniva, she's brilliant and very interesting. Pretty much.
She's either the CEO or the executive director of the
executive director. Yeah. Yeah.
And her first name is Shaniva. I can't think of her last name at the moment.
That's okay. There can't be that many Shanivas who are working with.
I also want to say that a public service announcement is brilliant. Was it in this group that the guy was talking about making a documentary?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a great idea. But boy, a PSA is a lot shorter and a lot less expensive and would be like lightning. It would be, I think we should all donate every penny we own and do it. So.
Shaniva McReynolds.
Oh, McReynolds. Yeah.
Thank you.
She's a PhD and she's the president of FAM.
Shaniva McReynolds. All right. All right, I will reach out. All right, John, you got another comment.
She is also one of the three guests who is scheduled to be on my program next week.
Nice.
And
tell us again what day that happens, what time?
A week from tomorrow. I know you put it in the chat. It's a week from tomorrow. I put it in the chat.
Wednesday, April 29th.
I put it in the chat. And I'd like to add a little bit and give you kind of a little teaser. I'm the one who brought that up about the PSAs to NS. Just a little bit of an idea of how we were talking about it. It's going to be set up, PSA, a family moves into a neighborhood. Two women are in a position to observe what's going on. The family members, they see from their window this family moving in. And then suddenly a third person shows up. Did you know that one of our new neighbors is a sex offender? And then we build on that. That's the teaser that I'm prepared to give out. We had some other details, but you want to find out more information, get in contact with me directly. But but this is where the whole thing is to challenge the stereotype as to who a monster is supposed to be. But again, that was something that we were working on, and it could be relatively quick and easy to do if you're going to film it like a television commercial or something like that. But I'll try to find what was done with this animated PSA, and I'm pretty sure it was out in California. I think I've got it somewhere in my files. But if I find
it up and put it in the chat.
If I can find it the program ends, I'll do it. If not, Anne, I'll send it to you, and then you can put it out. And then there were, Anne, I think there have been some programs that you've had of other people who were preparing documentaries about, let me see, Brain Dead. There's one about being on the registry. There's another one about the community of PFRs in Florida. And there was this very good, in my opinion, a very good, it's not a PSA or a documentary, but it's a good drama based on the McMartin Satanic Panic trial that was out in California in the late 80s, early 90s. And the name of that film is Indictment, the McMartin trial. And even though it's a dramatization, it is still very, very much worth a look because it stays pretty close to the facts.
Indictment, McMartin
Indictment,
trial.
the McMartin trial. If you want it on DVD, it's available, I believe, on HBO Video. And a little interesting point, the person who did the script for that particular film, a fellow by the name of Abby Mann. And Abby Mann did the screenplay for a very powerful film from the early 1960s called Judgment at Nuremberg. It's a
Okay.
dramatization of the Nuremberg war crimes trials, and it does not provide any easy answer. So Abby Mann has a good deal of experience or empathy with what he does. I see some people have asked for my email. I'll go on ahead. Yeah, Indictment, the McMartin trial. I'll put my contact information in the chat.
Okay. If we're running out of questions, we don't have to stay all the whole time. We can save the chat and regain 8, 12 minutes of our day. Does anybody have another question? There's a John question.
I'm being categorized. Okay. No. Mariah, a question for you. What are you going to be doing over the coming, say, weeks, months to make more people aware, not only of your group, but what you're talking about? And are you going to be appearing at any conferences, at any symposium in the, say, in the near future to spread the word?
So I don't have any plans for the near future to be doing anything in symposiums or conferences. But if you look up Marley Liss, and I will put her name in the chat here for you, Marley Liss, she is the Canadian survivor who founded Survivors for Justice Reform, and she is very active in doing exactly what you're saying. So she's out doing these speeches, right? She's going to universities, she's going to conferences, she's going and speaking to prosecutors, and she's telling them all about restorative justice and what she did with her case. And with her case, she specifically asked, her case was going through the criminal justice system, and she specifically asked for her offender to go to treatment and then restorative justice instead of going to a criminal trial. And she just she said it was the most
Somebody
healing
said yes.
yes he said
They
yes
agreed to
they did it, and she says it was the most healing experience, and she is in the process of writing a book, and she talks about her experience through her public speaking business. So that's what Marley's doing. As far as what I'm planning on doing in the near future is I'm more local. I'm specifically right now just doing things in Minnesota. So I'm trying to zero in on that. And I will be hopefully, once this diversion program starts going in Ramsey County, I do have a newspaper reporter, a reporter that I've been speaking with, who I'm hoping will write an article. And I'm hoping we'll have something published in the newspaper to get this, to have it be that more people are notified. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
Cool. Okay. So I found a chat from Marley Liss. Ah, she spoke at an Axel presentation. Was that Axel presentation filmed by any chance? I mean, not that I could find Marley Liss. A lot of work to build a program. Yeah, that is the truth. Okay. Well, all right. I want to tell everyone how to save the chat because, man, there's a lot of stuff in this chat. To save your chat, go into the chat. There's three dots on the top right. Say more. If you click on those three dots, it says save chat. I'm going to quick before you save it, I'm going to put my email in here and I'll put my put the helpline number in here.
For some
So there's
reason,
my.
I don't think I have the option.
You don't see an option of three dots. So is the chat, you have the chat open?
Yes.
At the top of the chat, you don't see, I see the war room and then three little gray dots underneath the X.
Oh, yeah, I don't have that available. It just says meeting chat and then it doesn't have the three dots available. Huh.
Chuck,
Okay.
you got any ideas?
If I could break in with a suggestion, Someone asked me, they also had some difficulty getting the chat. So for those of us who do have the three dots, once I save them, it goes into like a file and just forward a copy of the file to those who need it. So
Yeah, I've done that before. I've done that before. If your thing won't let you do it, so just if yours won't let you save the chat, just write down my email, which was I think the last thing I put in the chat. And then after I finish this, anybody who says, "Hey, I want that chat," I'll just send you the I'll send it to you through email. Okay. So Anne at War Family Foundation. Whoops. Dot org. I left off the dot org. Anne at warfamilyfoundation.org, edit. And then yeah, if anybody needs it after we're done, we will. Okay, check. All right. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Mariah, for your time and for everything you're doing. And man, I wish we could just clone. I wish I could clone like the Candace Polskys and the Brittany Lees and the Mariah Gibbons. Just clone them and just put them everywhere so that yeah. We need more of you. So thank you everybody for your time, and I will see you in 2 weeks. We have, I think, Trent McKenna is going to talk about post-conviction justice, and that's all I remember. All right, bye everybody.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.